Picture this, right? You clear some space on a table and you just set down two things. On the left, you've got a plastic bottle of like that sticky cherry flavored children's cough syrup.
Right, the kind you just grab off the shelf.
Exactly. You get it at your local pharmacy for what, $5? And then on the right side of the table, you place a sterile glass vial of ketamine.
Which is, a very powerful anesthetic.
Right, drawn up with a syringe under a super strict controlled substance license.
I mean, the visual contrast alone there highlights two entirely different universes of medicine. You've got one sitting in a suburban medicine cabinet for a kid's winter sniffles, basically.
Yeah.
And the other is, well, heavily guarded in operating rooms or deployed on battlefields, and more recently, administered in these very specialized clinics for severe depression.
Right, and if you looked at them side by side, you would literally never guess they were related. But our mission for today's deep dive is unpacking what is honestly one of the most fascinating plot twists in modern neuroscience.
It really is.
Because these two wildly different molecules have actually converged on the exact same molecular switch in the human brain.
They have, yeah. But before we unpack the mechanisms of how a cough syrup and a hospital anesthetic both became FDA-approved rapid-acting antidepressants, I should probably jump in here and be crystal clear about the nature of these
Oh,
substances.
absolutely.
Right, so this deep dive is strictly for educational purposes. It is not medical advice. We are discussing highly potent psychoactive drugs that carry serious, sometimes life-threatening risks. So neither of these should ever be used outside of strict medical supervision.
For sure. And if you or someone you know is in crisis, please reach out to a professional or call the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline in the US. Our mission today is really just to explore the science.
Exactly.
And honestly, if you've ever felt frustrated by the sort of glacial pace of traditional depression treatments, like waiting weeks or sometimes months for a standard SSRI to maybe start working, you are going to find this incredibly fascinating.
It's a game changer, for sure.
Yeah, we are looking at a totally new frontier in how we treat the brain, and it's driven by this totally unprecedented pharmaceutical convergence.
Because the speed of onset is the crucial factor here. It's what shifted the entire paradigm of modern psychiatry. But, to understand how a cough medicine and an anesthetic managed to do that, we kind of have to look at their completely separate origin stories first.
Yeah, let's start with ketamine. So that was developed back in the 1960s, right?
Yep, the early 60s.
And it gained massive prominence as a dissociative anesthetic during the Vietnam War because its primary advantage was that it didn't suppress a patient's breathing or drop their blood pressure the way other deep anesthetics did.
Right, which made it incredibly safe for battlefield surgeons to use in these really chaotic environments.
Wow. Okay. And then dextromethorphan or DXM, that goes back even further, right?
It does, yeah. DXM was patented in 1958, specifically as a non-narcotic cough suppressant.
Because they needed an alternative to opioids.
Exactly. The medical community was desperate to find a replacement for codeine in over-the-counter cough syrups to avoid, well, the obvious risk of opioid addiction.
So for decades, they basically existed in totally separate medical silos. The anesthesiologist has their ketamine, and the pediatrician has their DXM.
Right. And the breakthrough really happened when neuroscientists finally mapped out how these drugs functioned at a microscopic level.
And that's when they discovered they both target the same doorway in the brain, which is the NMDA receptor.
Yes. So the NMDA receptor is a glutamate receptor, and glutamate is the brain's primary excitatory neurotransmitter.
Meaning it's the thing that gets the brain going.
Right. It is the chemical signal that tells neurons to fire, to activate, to just pass messages along. And when researchers look closely at ketamine and DXM, they realize both molecules share a very specific, honestly, somewhat rare pharmacological classification.
Okay, lay it on me.
They are non-competitive, open-channel NMDA receptor antagonists.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because non-competitive open-channel antagonists, that is dense.
It is a mouthful, yeah.
Let's ground that in a physical space for a second. If we imagine the NMDA receptor as like a literal doorway that allows ions to flow into a neuron, how do these drugs actually interact with it?
Okay, so a standard competitive drug, it acts like a broken key. It gets shoved into the lock from the outside, basically blocking the real key from ever opening the door.
Makes sense.
But these two drugs, they are open channel antagonists. So the door actually has to be unlocked and swung wide open by the brain's natural glutamate first.
Wait, really? The door has to be open already.
Exactly. Once the door is open and traffic is flowing, the drug molecule slips inside the doorway itself and physically wedges itself in the frame.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, blocking anything else from getting through.
So it's kind of like a bouncer standing right in the middle of an open door, just stopping the crowd.
That is a perfect analogy.
Yeah.
And that physical blocking action inside the open NMDA channel is the defining characteristic of a family of drugs called dissociatives.
Which places ketamine and DXM in the exact same chemical family as what? Nitrous oxide.
Yeah, laughing gas.
Yeah.
And PCP, actually.
Crazy. So blocking that doorway isn't just about knocking someone out for surgery or, suppressing a cough reflex. It turns out putting a bouncer in that specific doorway can rapidly lift severe treatment-resistant depression.
It really can. And for a very long time, I mean, the dominant narrative in psychiatry was entirely focused on serotonin, the SSRIs like Prozac or Zoloft.
Right.
But the clinical research into this glutamate system revealed that if you target that NMDA receptor, you don't have to wait 6 to 8 weeks for a patient's mood to shift.
You can see profound antidepressant effects in a matter of hours or days, which is just wild.
It is. And both of these wildly different drugs eventually crossed the finish line at the FDA based on that exact mechanism.
So for ketamine, the specific formulation was the S-enantiomer, right? Branded as Spravato.
Yes, Spravato. It was approved for treatment-resistant depression in 2019.
And then in January of 2025, it hit a massive milestone. The FDA cleared it as a standalone monotherapy, so you didn't even need to pair it with an oral antidepressant anymore.
Exactly. And DXM followed hot on its heels. In August 2022, the FDA approved a daily pill called Auvelity for major depressive disorder.
And DXM is the active antidepressant ingredient in that pill.
It is, yeah. So we arrive at this incredible moment where a battlefield anesthetic and a cough medicine are both legitimate FDA-approved tools for depression targeting the same receptor.
But wait, if they both act as bouncers at the exact same NMDA doorway, a logical question arises here. Are they basically just two versions of the exact same drug? Like, should a patient expect the exact same biological response from both?
Not at all. Not even close, actually.
Really?
Yeah. Once they get past that shared doorway, the downstream biological cascades they trigger in the brain, and honestly, how the human body metabolizes them, they diverge dramatically. The
Huh?
similarity basically ends at the NMDA receptor.
Okay, let's look at those diverging downstream effects then, starting with ketamine. If ketamine blocks that NMDA doorway, how does that translate to curing depression?
So, ketamine is a highly potent NMDA blocker. Its rapid antidepressant effect is best explained by what we call the disinhibition hypothesis.
Disinhibition meaning like taking the brakes off a system.
Exactly. Think of the brain's neural network like a really crowded room. You have these inhibitory neurons called GABA interneurons,
Okay.
and their entire job is to act like strict teachers, constantly telling the surrounding neurons to quiet down and stop firing.
Keeping everyone in check.
Right. And ketamine preferentially targets and blocks the NMDA receptors on those specific inhibitory neurons. So if you suddenly silence the teachers who usually yell quiet
The
down,
room immediately gets louder.
exactly, you get a massive surge of neural activity. We call it glutamate surge, specifically localized in the prefrontal cortex, which is an area heavily implicated in mood regulation.
Right, of course.
And that sudden wave of glutamate floods the synapses and activates a totally different type of receptor called AMPA.
And this AMPA activation is where the real magic happens, right? Because it kicks off a biological cascade involving BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor.
Yes, exactly.
I've often heard BDNF described as like Miracle Grow for the brain.
Honestly, Miracle-Gro is a highly accurate way to visualize it because when AMPA receptors are activated by that glutamate surge, the cell releases BDNF, and that BDNF then activates a protein pathway called MTOR.
Okay, so think of MTOR as the brain's general contractor. When that pathway gets the signal, it tells the cellular machinery to literally start building new structural connections, right?
Yes, it grows new dendritic spines, which are the little branches neurons use to communicate. It physically rewires the neural circuits that chronic depression has withered away over time.
That is just incredible. The physical growth of those new synaptogenesis is the core of neuroplasticity.
It is. And we know this specific cascade is the mechanism because if you administer a drug that blocks the AMPA receptor step, ketamine's antidepressant effect vanishes completely.
Wait, completely.
Completely. Even if the patient still experiences the dissociative high, the depression doesn't lift.
That is fascinating. So the feeling of dissociation isn't what cures the depression. It's this massive biological construction project happening in the background, rebuilding the brain's physical hardware.
Right. Now, I will say the science is still rapidly evolving here. There are fierce, ongoing debates in neuropharmacology about ketamine's nuances.
Like what?
Well, ketamine actually comes in two mirror image shapes or enantiomers. You have esketamine and R-ketamine.
Okay.
Esketamine, the approved nasal spray, is the S form, which is a stronger NMDA blocker. But preclinical research shows the weaker R form also has potent antidepressant activity.
Yeah.
Yeah. And furthermore, there's a major debate about one of ketamine's breakdown products, a metabolite called HNK. A landmark study back in 2016 suggested HNK might cause those antidepressant effects by activating AMPA without blocking the NMDA receptor at all.
Wow, really?
Yeah, a decade later, scientists are still debating the exact ratio of how these different mechanisms actually contribute.
Okay, so if ketamine is this potent, highly targeted sledgehammer unleashing a massive wave of neuroplasticity, DXM sounds more like a Swiss Army knife. Like, it's doing a lot of different things at once.
That's a great way to put it. DXM plays a much quieter, vastly more complex pharmacological game.
How so?
Well, as an NMDA antagonist, the parent drug DXM is actually quite weak. When your body metabolizes it into its active byproduct, dextrorphin, it becomes a stronger NMDA blocker. But even then, DXM doesn't just rely on that massive glutamate surge we saw with ketamine. It is a genuine multi-target molecule.
Okay, so what other tools are on that Swiss Army knife?
It acts incredibly strongly on something called the sigma-1 receptor. It's a sigma-1 agonist.
What does that mean exactly?
We were talking about binding affinity in the nanomolar range, which means it tightly binds to this receptor at very low concentrations. Ketamine's affinity for sigma-1 is in the micromolar range, meaning it is exponentially weaker at that specific target.
Got it. And what do sigma-1 receptors even do?
They're fascinating, actually. They help regulate cellular stress and promote neuroplasticity, but through entirely different pathways than the AMPA surge.
So it's hitting plasticity from a different angle, but DXM doesn't stop there, right? It also acts as an SNRI, a serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor.
Yes. And this is where DXM really bridges the gap between new neuroscience and traditional psychiatry. SNRIs work by blocking the brain's recycling system.
Right.
Usually after serotonin and norepinephrine are released into the synaptic gap to send a mood-regulating signal, they get vacuumed back up. DXM clogs those vacuums, keeping those critical neurotransmitters active in the brain for much longer.
So it is doing some of the exact same heavy lifting as standard daily antidepressants like Effexor or Cymbalta, while simultaneously tweaking the glutamate system and hitting sigma-1.
Exactly. And animal models heavily suggest that DXM's antidepressant efficacy relies just as much on that sigma-1 agonism and SNRI activity as it does on the NMDA blockade.
Wow.
So to return to the original question, they belong to the same receptor family, but they play entirely different neurological music.
I love that.
Yeah, ketamine is a single potent blast of neuroplasticity. DXM is a softer, sustained chord of NMDA, sigma-1, and monoamine effects.
But because these two drugs operate through such different downstream mechanisms, they face completely different challenges in the human body. Which brings us to the massive plot twists in the DXM story.
The liver.
Right. If DXM is this amazing multi-target Swiss Army knife for depression, why didn't it just sit in the coffin cold aisle since 1958? Why didn't someone turn it into a daily depression pill 30 years ago?
The answer lies in the human liver, specifically an enzyme called CYP2D6.
Okay, let's use an analogy here for CYP2D6. Think of it like a very aggressive customs agent stationed in your liver.
I like that.
Its primary job is to inspect foreign molecules entering the body, tag them, and dismantle them before they can build up in the bloodstream. So for DXM, this customs agent shreds it down into that metabolite we mentioned, dextrorphin.
Right. But the massive hurdle for psychiatry here is that CYP2D6 is one of the most genetically variable enzymes in human pharmacology.
Meaning everyone has a different amount of these customs agents.
Exactly. Some people are what we call poor metabolizers. They have very few, very slow customs agents. For them, a single dose of DXM might have a biological half-life of 29.5 hours.
So the drug stays active in their system for well over a day.
Yeah. But contrast that with extensive or ultra-rapid metabolizers. Their livers are packed with highly aggressive customs agents working in overdrive.
Okay.
For those patients, the half-life of DXM is just 6.6 hours. And in some extreme rapid metabolizers, the drug is dismantled and cleared out so fast you can barely even detect it in their blood plasma.
So if you're a psychiatrist trying to prescribe a steady daily medicine for depression, that genetic lottery is a nightmare.
Oh, an absolute nightmare.
You give one person a pill, their liver destroys it instantly, and they get zero relief. You give the exact same pill to a poor metabolizer, and the drug compounds day after day, building up to potentially dangerous levels.
You simply cannot maintain steady, predictable, therapeutic brain levels of DXM on its own. And this metabolic hurdle is exactly what the creators of Auvelity finally solved. Auvelity is not just DXM. It is a combination pill containing DXM and bupropion.
Bupropion, which is widely known as Wellbutrin.
Yes.
Which is itself a common antidepressant.
Right, but while bupropion does treat depression in this specific formulation, it isn't playing the star player role. Bupropion is included because it happens to be a highly potent CYP2D6 inhibitor.
Ah, okay. So Auvelity essentially gives DXM a molecular bodyguard.
Basically, yeah.
The bupropion distracts and ties up all those aggressive customs agents in the liver, allowing the DXM to safely slip through into the bloodstream and make it to the brain.
That's a great way to picture it. The bupropion slows the breakdown just enough to force DXM to behave predictably across the entire genetic population.
Wow. And what about ketamine?
Well, ketamine bypasses this hepatic gauntlet entirely.
Right, because you don't swallow it.
Exactly. Ketamine is administered via intravenous infusion, an intramuscular injection, or as a nasal spray. It enters the bloodstream directly, skipping that first pass liver metabolism.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, it still breaks down into metabolites like norketamine and HNK,
yeah.
But it completely avoids that extreme CYP2D6 genetic variability that held DXM back for decades.
So because these drugs enter the body differently and hit different chemical targets, the physical reality for the patient, like how they access these drugs and what they experience taking them, is radically different.
Night and day, honestly.
The access gap between the two is just staggering.
We are looking at opposite ends of the regulatory spectrum here. Ketamine is a Schedule 3 controlled substance. You cannot just pick it up at a pharmacy window.
Right.
It requires administration in a certified clinic. Or, you know, under specific DEA telehealth flexibilities extended through 2026, it can be supervised remotely under very strict protocols.
Meanwhile, DXM remains federally unscheduled. It is literally an over-the-counter medicine. Now, over 20 states have passed laws restricting its sale to people under 18 to prevent recreational abuse. But fundamentally, it is still a household product you can buy at a grocery store.
And that access gap reflects the immediate physical experience of consuming the drugs. I mean, they're both dissociatives, which means they can profoundly detach a person's consciousness from their physical body and their surroundings.
Right.
But higher doses of ketamine can pull a patient into what is clinically known as the K-hole, a profound, immobile, highly disorienting state of detachment.
Which sounds intense.
Very.
Mm-hmm.
Medical supervision isn't just a regulatory hoop in that case. It is mandatory for patient safety during that vulnerable window.
So how does the DXM experience compare to that?
Well, DXM's dissociative effects are mostly driven by its dextrorphin metabolite. And in harm reduction and toxicology circles, recreational DXM use is often categorized into four escalating plateaus.
Plateaus?
Yeah, starting from mild, sort of alcohol-like euphoria, and scaling up to near complete visual and physical dissociation.
Wow.
So both molecules possess the raw power to take a patient off planet, so to speak. The difference is one happens monitored in a medical chair, and the other can happen unsupervised in a teenager's bedroom from a plastic bottle. Which is exactly why DXM misuse remains a distinct public health concern.
That makes total sense. So let's ground this neuroscience in the actual clinical scoreboards. We know the molecular mechanisms, we know the metabolic hurdles, but when we actually test these drugs formally in human beings suffering from depression, how well do they work?
We must state up front for scientific accuracy. There are no head-to-head clinical trials comparing ketamine directly against DXM.
Important caveat.
Yes. We are looking at two entirely separate bodies of research, funded by different entities, using totally different trial designs and patient populations. However, the data we do have for both is highly substantial.
Okay, let's start with Spravato, the esketamine nasal spray. What did the trial show there?
During the trials that led to Spravato's monotherapy approval, the data showed roughly a 22.5% remission rate at week 4. Compared to 7.6% for the patients given a placebo.
Okay, that's a big jump.
And even more importantly, they saw statistical separation from placebo, meaning the drug was working noticeably better than the dummy treatment as early as 24 hours after the first dose.
I mean, for anyone who has spent half a year cycling through different standard antidepressants hoping for relief, seeing a drug pull a quarter of patients into remission in a month with noticeable effects in a single day, that is a complete paradigm shift.
It truly is.
And what about Auvelity, the DXM bupropion pill?
So in their phase 3 Gemini trial for major depressive disorder, Auvelity demonstrated a 39.5% remission rate at week 6 compared to 17.3% for placebo.
Is incredibly robust data for depression. But it is important to keep the scoreboard honest regarding the broader applications of these mechanisms.
What do you mean?
Well, Auvelity's manufacturer recently expanded the drug's label. In April 2026, the FDA approved it for treating agitation in Alzheimer's disease dementia.
However, that approval followed a somewhat mixed clinical program. One of their pivotal trials, ADVANCE-2, actually missed its primary endpoint in 2024.
Interesting.
So the depression data is exceptionally solid, but as they try to apply this Swiss Army knife to other neurodegenerative conditions, the record becomes more uneven.
Got it. But the ultimate takeaway from these trials is that both drugs are highly effective for depression, but there is no universal winner here.
Right. You can't declare one universally better than the other.
And the reason for that becomes incredibly obvious when we examine the hazards, because they trigger totally different biological cascades and metabolic pathways. Their risk profiles are entirely different categories of danger.
They really are. Let's look at ketamine's hazard profile first.
Okay.
The risks of ketamine are heavily concentrated in the molecule itself, particularly the dangers of chronic repeated exposure. It carries a genuine risk of psychological dependence and abuse.
Because of the high.
Exactly. And acutely, it can cause transient spikes in blood pressure and heart rate during the infusion. Mm. But perhaps the most concerning risk for heavy, long-term users is irreversible bladder toxicity.
Wait, it physically damages the bladder?
Yes, a condition known as ulcerative cystitis.
Which essentially destroys the lining of the bladder, right? Causing severe pelvic pain and frequent urination. And from what I understand, the damage often doesn't heal even if you stop taking the drug.
Right. Permanently, in some cases.
Yeah.
The primary danger of ketamine is the cumulative toll the pure drug takes on the body over time.
DXM's dangers, however, are fundamentally different.
Completely different. DXM's sharpest hazards stem from combinations and drug interactions. Remember our discussion about DXM acting as an SNRI, blocking the reuptake of serotonin?
Yeah.
If a patient takes DXM while they are already on a traditional SSRI or an older MAOI antidepressant, the compounding effect can flood the brain with too much serotonin.
Triggering serotonin syndrome. And serotonin syndrome is not just a mild side effect. I mean, it causes high fever, severe tremors, seizures, and it can absolutely be fatal.
Which is exactly why Auvelity carries stark, explicit warnings about mixing it with other serotonergic drugs.
Good to know.
The other massive hazard with DXM, and this is mostly tied to the over-the-counter misuse we discussed, is the combination product problem.
Right, because that $5 bottle of cough syrup is rarely just DXM.
Almost never. It is usually a multi-symptom formula. So if an individual attempts to take a massive recreational dose to reach those dissociative plateaus, they are simultaneously swallowing massive toxic quantities of the other active ingredients.
Oh, that's really dangerous.
It is. A recreational dose of a combination syrup usually means ingesting lethal amounts of acetaminophen, which will rapidly destroy the liver, or antihistamines like chlorpheniramine, which can induce severe cardiac toxicity and fatal seizures.
Not to mention the poor metabolizers with the slow CYP2D6 liver enzymes. If someone doesn't know their genetic profile, a dose they think is safe could unexpectedly build up to toxic levels over a few days.
Exactly. The contrast in safety profiles is just stark. The risks of ketamine are about cumulative physical exposure to the pure drug. The risks of DXM are entirely about genetic liver variations and the deadly consequences of mixing it with the wrong medications or co-ingredients.
We've covered incredible ground today. I mean, we have two wildly different molecules from different eras of medicine converging as bouncers at the exact same NMDA doorway, yet rewiring the brain through totally different neuroplasticity pathways.
And carrying entirely different life-threatening risks.
Right. So how does a medical professional even begin to navigate this choice for a patient?
Well, it all comes down to clinical fit. We aren't crowning a champion here. We are evaluating the right tool for the specific patient.
Makes sense.
A psychiatrist looking at a patient with a history of severe substance use disorder or pre-existing bladder issues is going to steer far clear of ketamine. Conversely, if a patient is already stabilized on a complex cocktail of serotonergic medications, DXM is completely off the table due to the fatal risk of serotonin syndrome.
Right.
The true beauty of this scientific convergence is that it gives medicine two distinct keys to unlock the exact same therapeutic door. If a patient requires a potent, heavily monitored clinical intervention to rapidly break a severe depressive episode, we have ketamine.
Yeah.
If a patient is better suited for a daily oral pill that gently modulates that same glutamate system alongside traditional monoamines, we have Auvelity.
It is an incredible testament to how far neuroscience has evolved. And honestly, it leaves you with a lingering thought to carry with you.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, we took a Vietnam-era battlefield anesthetic and a 1950s child's cough syrup, and we eventually figured out how to use them to fundamentally alter the landscape of depression treatment.
It's wild to think about.
It really proves that medical breakthroughs don't always require inventing a shiny new molecule from scratch in a billion-dollar lab. Sometimes the most revolutionary treatments come from looking at old, mundane chemicals from a radically new angle.
Absolutely.
It really makes you wonder, what other over-the-counter staples currently sitting quietly in your medicine cabinet right now might be hiding complex neurological superpowers just waiting for the right molecular bodyguard to unlock them?
It is a profound question. And considering the pace of current research, I'm certain neuropharmacologists will be answering it in the years to come.
Until then, we'll keep reading the research. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. Catch you on the next one.